Good afternoon and welcome to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg and we are live once again for an hour. This is true each weekday afternoon. We open up the phone lines for an hour to allow you, the listener, access to these radio airwaves. If you have questions about the Bible or about the Christian faith and you'd like to bring those up, we'll discuss them together. If you have a different viewpoint from that of the host, we always welcome that. If you'd like to balance comment or discuss something that you've heard that you don't quite understand or simply can't agree with, feel free to give me a call. We have a line or two open right now if you want to call. The number 844-484-5737. The number again is 844-484-5737. Our first caller today is Skip, who's calling from Carlsbad, California. Skip, welcome to the Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Steve. I have a question about 1 Thessalonians, where Paul uses the word wrath three times, where he says Jesus delivers us from the wrath to come, and wrath has come upon the Jews, and also where he
to
says
the uttermost.
God did not appoint us to wrath. And my question is, what is this wrath? And I was wondering if it's future. And I'll take your answer off the air.
All right. Yeah. Thank you for calling. In 1 Thessalonians 1, Paul says that that Christ delivers us from the wrath to come. And in chapter 2, he says that the wrath has come upon the Jews to the uttermost, who are persecuting their Jewish countrymen. And then in chapter 5, he says that God has not appointed us to wrath, but to obtain salvation in the day of Jesus Christ. So what is this wrath? Now, when he says about the Jews that the wrath has come upon them to the uttermost, it definitely sounds like he's talking about something that is being experienced by the Jews at his time or perhaps immediately following. And there would be many who would suggest that he's alluding to the wrath that was brought upon Jerusalem and Israel during the Jewish War in 66 to 70 A.D. Of course, when Paul wrote, when Paul wrote Thessalonians, it was at least a decade before that, if not more so. But nonetheless, some people feel that this reference to the wrath has come upon them to the uttermost is referring to the retribution coming on the Jewish state. Because of their crucifying Christ and so forth, and we know that something very much like that did happen. However, when he talks about us being delivered from wrath, I don't see it very likely that he's talking about 70 A.D. for the simple reason that the Thessalonians didn't live anywhere near Jerusalem. They were in Greece. And it's, in my opinion, is that what happened in Jerusalem would not have a tremendous impact on Christians or probably even Jews so much in Greece. Although all Jews throughout the world would be impacted by the destruction of their capital city and the temple, but nonetheless, the readers in Thessalonica were almost entirely Gentiles, at least predominantly. So I don't really see that the wrath that the Thessalonians were delivered from, or that God has not appointed for us, is a reference specifically to what happened to the Jews in AD 70. My thought is that wrath speaks more of a generic hatred for sin that God has, which results in judgment. And, of course, such wrath was exhibited toward the Jewish state in 70 A.D. It was God's judgment upon them. But that wrath is a feature of God's dealing with humanity in general. And, of course, when he says he delivers us from the wrath to come, I don't think he's talking about specifically the wrath that came on the Jews in A.D. 70, since the Thessalonians were hardly delivered from that, since they were never within its trajectory. So I think that it more of the generic wrath, that God's anger towards sin. We were all sinners, certainly, and therefore we were on a collision course with the wrath of God, which I believe will be exhibited to all people on the last day in the judgment. And so that's the wrath I think he probably is saying the Thessalonians have been delivered from. That is a future thing, but on the other hand, see, wrath isn't an event or a thing. Like I said, it's an attitude that God has towards sin. And remember, it says in John chapter 3 that he that believeth not shall not see life, but the wrath of God abides upon him. The wrath of God dwells on those who are in rebellion against God. So it's more like his general attitude of disapproval toward their behavior. In Romans chapter 1, Paul said in verse 18, the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness of men who suppress the truth in their unrighteousness. So there's the wrath of God. Paul says it is exhibited from heaven. And one has to ask, well, in what sense does Paul see the wrath of God as currently manifested or exhibited from heaven? But he goes on in chapter 1 of Romans to point out that there are people who, because they knew God and rejected the knowledge of God and did not like to retain the knowledge of God, God gave them over ultimately to a reprobate mind so that they no longer seem to have a conscience about right and wrong. And I think that's the exhibition of God's wrath, that we can see it. We can see the wrath of God on certain people because they don't seem to fear God. They don't seem to have a sensitivity to what's right and wrong. That which we see on certain people, I think, is the manifestation of God's wrath. It's God has actually, in wrath, consigned them to that reprobate mind. So wrath isn't always talking about the same thing. When Paul said in 1 Thessalonians 5 that God has not appointed us to wrath, there are many people who think that he's referring specifically to a period of 7 years at the end of this history, which they call the tribulation period. And they see that as a time of God's wrath poured out on the earth. And for that reason, there are many dispensationalists especially who believe that Paul is talking about a pre-trib rapture, where he says God has not appointed us to wrath. The way they apply that is they believe that there's a period of wrath coming the last 7 years, and God hasn't appointed us for that, so he's going to rapture us before that time. And this, in fact, is one of the favorite verses to support a pre-trib rapture. But its use in that argument is very weak, if not entirely without strength, because Paul does not in any place identify the wrath of God with a particular period of time, certainly never with a 7-year tribulation period. There's never any time in the Bible that even speaks specifically of a 7-year tribulation period. We get the idea of that from the fact that the 70th week of Daniel is obviously 7 years, but there's nothing in the Bible that equates the 70th week of Daniel with the tribulation. So there's tinkering going on with the different texts to make this idea. But the likelihood that Paul is referring to the tribulation period when he talks about God has not appointed us to wrath is, to my mind, not great, because he doesn't say God has not appointed us to wrath, but rather to be raptured before that wrath is poured out. He says he's not appointed us to wrath, but rather to salvation. So I believe that wrath is the opposite of salvation. And in that passage in 1 Thessalonians 5, I think it's probably the same as in chapter 1, where he says that Christ has delivers us from the wrath to come. I believe he's talking about the wrath of God that will be exhibited in the judgment of the last day. Obviously, as I mentioned, there are people who see some of those passages differently, but you asked my opinion. That is my opinion. And I'm the world's greatest authority on my own opinion. So that's how I would answer that question. All right, let's talk to Judy from San Francisco, California. Judy, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Thank you, Steve. I would like you to check your authority on your opinion regarding the preterist view. You've opened my mind to an entirely different possibility than I've ever heard before, and I find it very exciting. Basically because I'm going through Revelation with BSF, and I've had no teaching. I've just had little bits from your show.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
And it's been wonderful. All of a sudden, God's opening stuff that I had never seen before. My question comes in on the Book of Life. As I'm looking at it, it seems to me that people's names are... I'll tell you what I think, and then please...
I know where this question's going, and it's perplexing even to me, but go ahead.
Okay. It appears as if names are in a book. I've learned this lots of times.
Written before the foundation of the world, but could be removed.
Yes. And people don't think you can get your name taken out of the Book of Life, and yet I look at Exodus 32 and 33.
Moses says, if not, then blot my name out of your book.
Yes.
Right?
And then
mm-hmm.
God says, I will. Not yeah. Moses, but I'll anyone who sinned against me, I will blot him out.
Mm-hmm.
So that's pretty much the question, because I had made that statement in class, and I'm getting scriptures of, you know, John 6:37 that and 30 to 39, I shall lose none of those that thou hast given me, mm-hmm. but raise them up at the end of the last day. Things like this. I'm sure there's lots more, but I'm confused.
Yeah. Well, in John chapter 6, Jesus doesn't actually predict that he will lose none. He says, this is the will of the Father who sent me, that of all that he has given me, I should lose nothing. I uh-huh. should raise it up at the last day. He's saying it's not God's will for him to lose any, but he did lose one. And
yes.
he actually mentions that in chapter 17 of John, where he's praying. He says, Father, of all those that you've given me, I have lost none of them except the son of perdition, you know.
Right.
So apparently, if you are given to Christ by God, that does not mean you can't be an exception and be one of those that actually is lost. But Jesus says it's not God's will that any of them should be lost, and I certainly would agree with that. The Book of Life issue, like I said, it's a perplexing thing, because the Book of Revelation mentions the Book of Life a number of times, and not in ways that are easily harmonized with each other, because he says in chapter 3 that those those who overcome,
yes.
he will not blot their name out of the book of life, which makes it sound like if they don't overcome, he will blot their name
yes.
out of the book of life. Near the end, in chapter 22, some manuscripts read, if anyone takes away from the words of this book, I will take away his part from the book of life.
Yes.
But the older manuscripts say from the tree of life. So that doesn't enter in necessarily to the problems with this passage. The main thing is that there does seem to be the ability to have your name taken out, because there's a promise that those who are overcomers, and it's spoken in such a way as to suggest that not everyone in the church necessarily would fall into that category, but those who overcome will not have their names removed from the book of life. Now, what does overcome mean? Overcome means being faithful unto death. Remember Revelation 12:11. It says they overcame by the blood of the Lamb, the word of their testimony, and they did not love their lives even unto death. So those who were faithful unto death are the ones who overcame. An overcomer is one who endures to the end, faithful to Christ. And they will not have their name blotted out. But the implication is, if you don't remain faithful unto death, well, there's no such promise. Your name could be blotted out. But the problem is harmonizing that with the statements in Revelation that talk about, I think twice, talks about the people whose names were written in the Lamb's Book of Life from the foundation of the world, or
yes.
Yeah, and I think, well, wait a minute here, or the Lamb that was slain before the foundation of the world. It seems to me like it's saying that the names in the book were put there before any of us were born. It sounds very much like a Calvinistic idea,
yeah.
a predestination. Although the suggestion of having the name removed doesn't sound very much like a Calvinistic idea, because it would suggest no guarantee of perseverance. So it seems like this Book of Life imagery that Revelation uses, different things are said at cross purposes with each other, and I'm not really sure how to solve that. I have come to realize over the past decades, as I've studied Revelation, that the Book of Revelation is not really to be understood in a exactly literal way, and that much of what it says is impressionistic. It's trying to make an impact, trying to get across an idea, and sometimes it just doesn't even seem like it's speaking consistently with itself, because, for example, in chapter 19, we are referred to as the Lamb's wife, and the wedding has come, and we're the bride. But then the very next verse says, blessed are those who are invited to the wedding. I presume that's us. But if we're the bride, it should go without saying that we're invited to our own wedding. But it sounds like the church is sometimes the guests invited, sometimes the church is the bride herself. Likewise, else in other passages in the Bible, that seems to be the case, like the parable of the wedding feast in Matthew 22, we're the ones who are invited, whereas in Ephesians 5, we're the bride. So it seems like some of the images are, first of all, I don't mind if someone disagrees with me about this, but I don't believe God really has a literal book with names in it. I believe this is imagery. I don't think God has to store information in books like we do. I think it's an anthropomorphism. I think God actually remembers things without having to look them up, you know, in books. So I suspect that there's not a literal book, and the reference to having the names written in the book or having names taken out of the book or whatever, they're getting across an idea. But sometimes the different passages if you take it too literally, you're going to the ideas are going to be cross purposes with each other. And I've never been able to find some way to take that in a literal sense that harmonizes all the things that are said. I do believe, though, that it is correct to say that we who are saved have been known to God since before the foundation of the world. I believe that God foreknows all who will be saved. I don't think that translates into a doctrine of individual particular predestination as Calvinists understand it, but I do believe that God knows who are his own, who are his people, even before they become his people. So to say our names were written in the book before the foundation of the world, no doubt, if not entirely literal, could simply be pointing out that God has known who we are since before, long before we were born. But there's also this other business about having your name removed, which really, it technically wouldn't make sense. If your name can be removed, what was the point of writing your name in there before the foundation of the world? I mean, it obviously was written there before you became a Christian, so it must have been written there saying you're going to become a Christian. But then if you're going to end up not a Christian after all, then why put it in the first place? It's trying to make it all match together is something that's above my pay grade, but I think that I take these things as giving an impression. Many of the visions and revelation and statements of revelation, I think, are for impressionistic purposes rather than literal, trying to picture a literal book and so forth.
Okay. That helps a lot.
All right.
I just want to say that I'm so grateful for the door you've opened for me. Going through Revelation has been, I labored through it every year, but I have to say it's a kick and a half now that I have light that I can see things I never saw before. And I have that because you opened that door for me.
Well, I'm very glad to hear it. Are you acquainted with my book, Revelation Four Views?
I've heard you speak of it, yes.
Yeah. I know you say you're going through BSF, and I know they're going through Revelation right now. And they take the futurist view of Revelation. There are, as you know, there's the preterist view. You're obviously expressing familiarity with that. And there's two other views, too. And all of them have a respectable case in their favor.
Yes. I listened to you for a long time, and I've heard you speak of this. And I've had a lot of teaching on all of it, but never preterist. So that's why I was so grateful, because I could never make it work for me. But all of a sudden, I'm seeing things I never saw before. It's just really fun.
Are you aware that you can hear my verse-by-verse teaching through Revelation from the website?
Yes, and I would love to. I just don't have a computer at home.
Oh, well, that makes it difficult.
Yeah.
All right.
So when that comes, I will, without a doubt.
Well, thank you, Judy, for calling. I appreciate your comments.
Well, thank you, Steve. I so appreciate you and your show. Thank you so much.
Sorry, I can't give a better answer about the Book of Life. There's a lot of things I can't give good answers about.
It's a good answer. Thank
you. All right.
All right.
All right. God bless you, too.
Bless you, too. Bye.
Bye now. All right. Our next caller is going to be Michael from Santee, California. Michael, good to hear from you again.
Thank you. Good to talk to you, Steve. My question today is from Revelation 7 and thinking about the 144,000.
Uh-huh.
And when the 12 tribes are listed there, it's different than the other two lists that are in the Old Testament.
Yeah, it leaves out Dan.
Yeah, they leave out Dan, and only one of Joseph's sons is in there. And
well, it has the tribe of Joseph and the tribe of Manasseh listed separately, and yet Manasseh is part of the tribe of Joseph. So it's a strange list. You're right.
So why do you think that happened like that?
I don't know of any good answers to that question. You know, some of the church fathers thought the tribe of Dan was omitted because they said the Antichrist would come from the tribe of Dan. But there's exactly zero biblical reason to believe that. There's just absolutely nothing in the Bible to say Antichrist will come from the tribe of Dan. And so it was seemingly just kind of a desperate attempt to explain the inexplicable. The tribe of Dan is omitted. Some commentators say Dan is omitted because Dan was the first of the tribes to get into idolatry. Though we don't really know if that's true. It is true that there's a story at the end of the book of Judges about a group of people in the tribe of Dan who kidnapped a priest and made him their priest to worship idols, I guess. But we're not told that they were the first people to do so. It's just a story about some people who were of the tribe of Dan. So really, there's an awful lot of conjecture behind any answer that could be given. As far as Joseph and Manasseh being mentioned separately, I think Joseph is just another term in this case for Ephraim. Ephraim was such a considerably larger tribe than almost any of the other tribes besides Judah that to call the tribe of Ephraim the tribe of Joseph would be not too out of line, because the tribe of Manasseh, which was the other part of the tribe of Joseph, was considerably smaller and less significant. So I think Joseph just stands in as another term for Ephraim. That would explain that. But the Dan omission of Dan, who can say? No one can say really with certainty. I will say this, though. In different lists of the 12 tribes in the Old Testament, there does seem to be a deliberate effort to keep the listing numbered at 12. 12 is an important number, and yet if you list all the names of the tribes, you're going to have 13 because, of course, the tribe of Joseph is two tribes, Ephraim and Manasseh, and often they are mentioned as separate. And so when this is so, they have to leave out another tribe. A lot of times in the listing, Levi is the tribe left out because they are somewhat of a unique tribe. But in this case, Levi is included in Revelation 7's list, and so someone else has to be bumped. Maybe Dan was just bumped because they were at the furthest north extremity of the country, and they, you know, and maybe they got, who knows? I don't have a good answer, obviously. So I can't answer that for you. All I can say is I don't think the list is literal anyway. I just believe that in saying there's 12,000 from this tribe, 12,000 from that tribe, and so forth, it's simply telling us that the remnant that is saved is a representation of the whole nation of Israel. Now, of course, there's a lot of people who believe that they are representative of the spiritual Israel, and it's not even talking about the tribes of Israel, but that it's talking about the church. I'm not of that opinion, although I do believe a lot of references to Israel in the Bible are really about the church. But I think that the 144,000 in Revelation 7 are contrasted with the group that's mentioned after them, which is an innumerable company from every kindred, people, nation, and tongue, which would be, of course, I believe the church, comprised very largely of Gentiles from all nations, as well as some Jews. But I think what's going on in Revelation 7 is that, of course, as a preterist, I believe this is the setting is the impending doom of Jerusalem. And I think the 144,000 are those of the remnant of Israel, that is the Christian Jews, who escaped before the Romans besieged the city. We have information about them to that effect, I think, in chapter 14 of Revelation. The first four verses is the only other place they are mentioned. And in that place, we are told that the 144,000 are without guile. In their mouth, there's no guile. Remember Jesus, when he saw Nathanael, said, "Behold, an Israelite indeed, in whom is no guile." That is, he was not a hypocrite like the Pharisees. He was a genuine Israelite. So are these people, like Nathanael was, disciples. They follow the Lamb wherever he goes, it says. Well, they're disciples then of Jesus. He's the Lamb. It also says of them that they are the first fruits to God. Now, that's interesting because James, who's writing to, as he says, the 12 tribes scattered abroad, James is writing to Jewish Christians. He says in chapter 1, "Of his own will begat he us to be a kind of first fruits of his creatures." That is, the first century Christian Jewish people that James was writing to, and including himself, he said, "We're the first fruits." And Revelation 14 says that the 144,000 are the first fruits, which, again, some people think the 144,000 belong to a period that's still in the future, but if they're at the end of the age, they should be called the last fruits. But the first fruits of the church, according to Scripture, are the Jewish believers in Jerusalem in the first century, and that's who I think the 144,000 are. But the second group that's innumerable and multi-ethnic and multinational, I think refers to, the Gentiles are added to the Jewish remnant, grafted in, as it were, to the olive tree, and comprise, you know, the multi-ethnic church. So I think what Revelation 7 is saying is this, that though there's a judgment coming on Jerusalem, God's going to spare his faithful remnant of Jews, and he's going to add to them an innumerable number of Gentiles who will also be with them worshiping God and waving their palm branches and so forth. But why Dan is left out, again, I have no insight.
Interesting. That brings up an interesting point. Is it possible that the Holy Spirit is saying that there was no spiritual remnant left in Dan?
Well, it is a possibility, but I wouldn't press for that. You know, I mean, there's a lot of possibilities with revelation that would be impossible to prove one way or the other. If somebody sure. wanted to entertain that notion, I wouldn't fight with them over it.
Yeah, it's as good as explanation as any, I suppose. Okay, thank you, Steve.
Okay, Michael, thanks for your call.
God bless you, brother.
You
all
too.
Right, bye-bye.
Bye now. All right, our next caller is Chris calling from Canada. Chris, good to hear from you again. Welcome.
Good afternoon. My question today is there any biblical evidence to suggest that we may possibly be reunited with loved ones when we die? I've always been growing up believing that when we die, we're just disembodied spirits singing to God in heaven, although I do realize there Jesus was resurrected himself, and he was a man, and people recognized him. So I wonder why it's so commonly
barely
taught.
They sometimes didn't. Sometimes they didn't for some strange reason, but he was the same guy. You're right. It's the same Jesus. First of all, when we talk about being disembodied spirits, I believe that after we die, we are disembodied spirits in heaven, but not forever, because Jesus is going to come back here, and he's going to resurrect our bodies, and we will no longer be disembodied spirits. In my understanding, we'll live on the new earth with Christ for eternity. So this disembodied state in heaven, I think, is a temporary thing between the time, we call it the intermediate state between death and resurrection. Now, how much we may or may not be united with loved ones in heaven during that intermediate state, I don't know. But certainly in eternity, when we're resurrected, I think we have a lot of time to look up our old friends if we want to. We've got it forever. Even if they're hard to find, we'll probably have time to find them. I do think we'll recognize each other. Like you said, people did recognize Jesus somewhat belatedly. Half the time they weren't sure. Even the 12 disciples, or seven of them, by the Sea of Galilee, when he was feeding them fish in the morning that day in John 21, it says, it very strangely says, none of them dared ask him who he was, for they knew it was the Lord. Isn't that a strange statement? None of them dared to ask him who he was. Obviously, it must mean they wanted to, but they knew it was him. So why would they want to ask? You know, it's like they knew it was, but there was something about him, you know, different. And obviously Mary Magdalene didn't recognize him initially. The two men on the road to Emmaus didn't recognize him initially. There must have been something about him that looked a little different, but he still had the scars. So it was obviously his same body had come out of the grave and was now glorified, but had taken on an aspect that made him not immediately recognizable, but they did recognize him ultimately. And I suppose when we're in our resurrected bodies, I hope I look different, but nonetheless, I think I can make myself recognizable to my friends.
Thank you very much. That was very helpful.
Okay, Chris, thanks for your call.
No problem.
Bye now. Good talking to you again. You're listening to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. Our next caller is Michael from Live Oak, California, our Buddhist friend who's been calling me for, 15 years or something? Who knows? But we always have good conversations, but we do have lines open, too. And you can reach me at this number, 844-484-5737. That's 844-484-5737. You know, Michael, I'm going to have to stop introducing you as the Buddhist friend, because eventually you're going to be a Christian, and you're going to have this identity in the mind of our listeners as the Buddhist, but you won't be the Buddhist anymore.
Oh,
how you doing?
Boy. Oh, boy. In Yiddish, they say, Oy Gavalt.
Oy Gavalt. He's a Jewish Buddhist at that.
That's right. Anyway, Steve, speaking of the Old Testament, so I don't know if it was on KKMC or where did I hear this? Or maybe on some other radio station, a reference to Deuteronomy, where it states that a child who is disobedient to his parents should be stoned. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Now, with all due respect, that just seems so harsh. I mean, can you imagine today if something like that in the Western world occurred, there would be an outcry. And this is just
what there'd be is a lot less rebellious kids, I think.
In my mind, this is absolutely irreconcilable with the teachings of Jesus, of love and mercy. Please explain.
The difference between the teachings in Deuteronomy and the teaching of Jesus are explicable by the fact that Deuteronomy was written to the Jewish nation, which had courts of law and law enforcement and penalties and armies and borders to defend like any other nation, whereas Jesus didn't come and establish a political nation. He came to establish a kingdom under himself, which was entered and enjoyed through a spiritual connection, and not we don't have any political borders. The church doesn't have any courts of law, prisons, executioners, and things like that. That simply is a different kind of a kingdom. Israel, like every nation, had a criminal justice code. Now, unlike some nations, it had some things that were illegal that would not be illegal everywhere. For example, working on the Sabbath. There was a death penalty for that. Cursing God or blaspheming God, there was a death penalty for that. Being perennially rebellious against your parents, there was a death penalty for that. Witchcraft, there was a death penalty for that. Now, we wouldn't have death penalties for any of those things. For one thing, in the church, we wouldn't. Although if someone persisted in those areas, we would have the equivalent, which is excommunication. You know, when Paul said that to kick the man out of the church who was living with his mother's wife in 1 Corinthians 5, he said at the end of that chapter, therefore put away from yourselves that wicked person. He's quoting from Deuteronomy. Many times in Deuteronomy it says, thus shall you put away from yourselves that evil person. And it's always in the case of places where the death penalty was exercised in Deuteronomy. Instead, the church doesn't kill people. The church simply has to disfellowship them. And that's the equivalent in the church of what a nation would do to discipline incorrigible criminals. Now, here's the thing, Michael. I don't know whether you believe in capital punishment for anything.
No,
or not.
I don't.
No, see, so we're not going to, we're probably going to get along like a slow waiter and a poor tipper here on this. But the point is, I believe in that. I believe there are some things that are worthy of death. And certainly murder has always been said to be an issue worthy of death from before the time of Moses. And other things were added. Now, the things that Deuteronomy laid out as death penalty crimes were things that God believed were absolutely destructive to the safety of the community. Now, the community of Israel was not like the community of other nations. It had a special relationship with God based on its covenant, based on loyalty to God. And God knew very well, as anyone can see from reading Israel's history, that there would be a tendency for them to go after other gods and to be unfaithful to God. And there were certain behaviors that would be particularly likely to bring this apostasy into the nation. And there was a zero tolerance policy God had for those behaviors. That's why there was a lot more capital crimes in Deuteronomy than there would be in any other society that we know of. But you see, if we acknowledge, and you don't, but if we acknowledge that some crimes are bad enough that they deserve the death penalty, then it's simply a matter of letting God tell us which ones are that bad. We could say, well, I don't think they're that bad. But then we have to decide, who knows more about this, me or God? You know, whenever I see God placing a penalty on some behavior that I personally think, well, that seems a little excessive. Well, what that tells me is not that God's got to make some changes in his thinking. It tells me I've got to make some changes in my thinking, because God has never, ever, set some penalty on any action that was not just.
Steve,
God has never been unjust. So I'm the one who needs to adjust my thinking. Go ahead.
Steve, if you go back to King David, if you go, and Paul himself had persecuted Christians, it doesn't seem to be evenly dispensed or.
You're right. You're right. The law was never very consistently applied. The law that God gave through Moses was a law that Paul himself said in Romans 7, it's a law that was holy, just, and good. But of course, a holy and just and good law doesn't guarantee that the society that's under it is going to be a holy and just and good society, because they don't always obey the law, and Israel seldom did. What I'm talking about here is that when God gave the law, it was instructional. In fact, the word Torah, law, actually means instruction.
Uh-huh.
And Paul said in Galatians that the law was a schoolmaster. It teaches us something. Now, one thing it teaches us is how bad certain behaviors are that we wouldn't have thought were that bad. I tell you, I've had rebellious children before, and I've never had the least bit interest in killing them. Uh-huh. I would never think that what they're doing is that bad.
That's right.
I mean, it's bad. It's bad. I don't like it, but I wouldn't have thought of it as capital crime. But if God says it is, well, then I can be instructed by his law. I can say, wow, this is worse. It doesn't mean I'm supposed to go out and kill them. Like I said, Christians don't have courts of law and criminal justice. They were not supposed to.
Mm-hmm.
That's for political states. We're not a political state. We're a spiritual nation, and all of our interactions in that respect are spiritual. But the thing here is that what Deuteronomy actually said was that if a son is incorrigible, and we're not talking about a young son, we're talking about one who's a drunkard and a glutton, it says. The parents who cannot control their young adult son because he's continually getting drunk against their wishes in their home even. And, you know, he's basically refusing their authority. This is something that is seen not as, you know, a one-time offense. The Bible isn't saying that if a child ever disobeys his parents, kill him. It's describing a person who is incorrigible and too big for his parents to discipline,
but
therefore the community disciplines him.
Compare that with the prodigal son parable. I mean, it's just it's night and day.
Well, of course, the prodigal son parable functions differently than the law. The prodigal son parable is describing the tax collectors and sinners that Christ was happily receiving to himself in terms of a son who's been alienated from a father who wants him to come back. And, of course, it's not a true story. It's an illustrative story. But and by the way, I don't know of any case in the Bible. I believe there are no cases recorded where a rebellious son was put to death. Sometimes they should have been. Absalom certainly deserved to be put to death. He died in war, though. There certainly were a lot of sons who deserved it. But we don't find the nation of Israel really carrying this out. What we do find is that God is saying, if the parents can't control their son, the community comes to their rescue. Now, I'll tell you this. If you lived in a society where perennial rebellion against your parents resulted in the death penalty, you probably wouldn't rebel against your parents like that. You see, here's the thing, Michael. Some people say, well, these penalties, they're too severe. The penalty for witchcraft, the penalty for adultery, the penalty for rebellious children, they're too severe. It's unfair. But wait a minute. Nobody has to do any of those things. That is to say, no one has to get involved with witchcraft. It's not like there's a gun to your head saying you have to commit witchcraft. These are things that you can choose not to do. And if you lived in a society where they were capital crimes and where it was likely that the capital sentence would be carried out, you probably would choose not to do them. The fact is, God never places any penalty on any behavior that someone must necessarily do. For example, there's no penalty on breathing or on sleeping, but there is a penalty on doing things that you could easily not do. So the real question is, do you fear God? Israel was commanded to fear God, and those who fear God and fear the penalties that God has would walk uprightly, and people did. There were people who did.
But the fun, okay. But my point, my reason for calling, what I'm trying to point to, the fundamental difference between fearing God, I don't want to be executed. I don't want to have the wrath of God upon me. That is so different from the people who hung out with Jesus and were touched.
Well, you're right. You're right. And I'm not saying that those people who obeyed these laws out of mere fear of retribution had a good relationship with God, but they at least were able to stay in the community without doing any harm to anyone else because they behaved. You see, God would desire that everyone would love him and obey him because they love him. But if they're not going to do it that way, he still has to maintain some kind of order in the community. And so those Jews who did not love God still were required to behave in a way that was consistent with the standards of the community. And rebellion against your sons, against your father and mother, excuse me, was inconsistent with those standards. Now, Michael, you and I are really never going to come to eye to eye on this until such a time as you and I have the same opinion about God. As a Buddhist, you don't even believe there is a person.
Well, no, but so I've been touched by the Spirit of Christ. I mean, I that is so beautiful, and it just seems so different, so really contrary to this harsh eye for eye, tit for tat attitude.
Well,
that seems to be.
I know what you're saying, Michael. I know what you're saying, but when you say you've been touched by the Spirit of Christ and it's so contrary to the God of the Old Testament, then you haven't experienced the Spirit of Christ in his entirety, because Christ said that the law of Moses was from God. In fact, Jesus said in Mark chapter 7, he castigated the Pharisees because they kept their traditions at the expense of keeping what he called the commandment of God. And then he gave two examples of the commandment of God that Jesus said they should be keeping. He said, for Moses said, you shall honor your father and your mother. That's one law. Then he gave another one. And whoever dishonors or whoever curses father or mother, let him die the death. Now, Jesus quoted both those laws. And he said, now you don't do that. So you make the word of God to no effect. In other words, he said that both the fifth commandment about honoring your parents and the commandment about putting to death rebellious children, he said both of those are the commandment of God. And instead of keeping them, the Pharisees had made excuses and loopholes and outs so that people could neglect the care of their parents. But it's interesting that the very thing that you're mentioning as being contrary to the Spirit of Christ in Deuteronomy is something that Christ himself quoted as an authoritative word from God. So when you say you've felt the Spirit of Christ, I think what you have felt is when you've been among Christians, you feel acceptance and love, which ought to be felt by everyone who's among Christians. And that is the Spirit of Christ. But that's not all there is to the Spirit of Christ. The same Jesus is going to come and judge the world.
I'm not saying, from an Eastern point of view, there is karma. That there are consequences for, say, acting out of harmony with the law, or lawful or dharmic or benevolent intention. I understand that, but Jesus seemed to be bending over backwards to get people to get on board with that, to enter into his grace.
Absolutely, and Jesus made it very clear. He said, the Son of Man did not come to destroy men's lives, but to save them. It's true. It also says the Son of Man did not come to condemn the world, but that the world through him might be saved. So Jesus didn't come as an agent of judgment.
Yeah.
Not the first time. Second time he comes, he'll come in judgment. Both aspects are part of him, but not both of them were part of his mission when he was here the first time. He didn't come here to judge. He came here to save. There will be a time when he comes to judge. And when he does, it will not be out of character for him. He's the Son of the same God. And the apple does not really fall far from the tree. His father is the one who gave those commands that many people find harsh. And Jesus owned the legitimacy of those laws. So some people have a view of Jesus, and they really love Jesus because they have this kind of truncated image of Jesus in their mind, that he's just so gentle, walking around with limp wrists and wet fingernails and so forth. Right. And actually, the Jesus in the Bible is considerably more robust than what many people think, and much more concerned about righteousness than some people want to make him out to be. It's true, people will take an aspect of his teaching where he surprises people by saying, love your enemies and do good to those who persecute you and so forth. Pray for those who despitefully use you and bless those who curse you. Jesus said those things and he meant them. That's exactly how he wants us to relate to each other, that we might be like God is, because God does that. But God ultimately has a role we don't have, and that is as the judge of the universe. So we're told in Romans, Paul says, do not avenge yourselves, but leave it to God to do so, because God says, vengeance is mine,
that's
I will repay.
That's right.
Yeah. So actually, we are forbidden to do some things that God alone has the prerogative of doing.
Sure, but the basic spirit of Jesus seems to be about, to a great degree, about mercy and compassion.
No doubt. No doubt that's a very strong emphasis in the teaching of Jesus. But
and
it's not the only.
What I get from Leviticus and those Old Testament legal or those protocols, it seems so quick. It seems very much like the Islamic Sharia law, so quick to just dismiss somebody as a lost cause and end their life or whatever.
The law in Leviticus and Deuteronomy both command love for your enemy. They both say if your enemy's donkey is going astray, you take it back to him, even if it's inconvenient to you. If your enemy's donkey is fallen under its burden and you'd rather not help, you have to anyway. You have to help your neighbor, even if he's your enemy. So being kind to your enemy is found in the law. It's found in Proverbs, where it says if your enemy is hungry, feed him. If he's thirsty, give him drink. It's found in the prophets. this showing mercy to enemies. So when Jesus taught loving your enemies, he wasn't actually introducing a new idea. It was also found in the law and the prophets, but he was definitely coming with a different emphasis because, again, he was not coming to establish a political nation where there were courts of law and crimes had to be punished in the church and things like that. We are a spiritual nation, a spiritual community, and therefore the church isn't supposed to be killing people. But if you were a magistrate of a political nation and people did things that were in fact worthy of death, then putting them to death would be the right thing and not even an unmerciful thing, because to take a criminal, a violent criminal or otherwise a dangerous person out of the population, it might not seem very nice way to treat the criminal, but it's a much nicer way to treat the population than if you let the guy walk. I mean, Jesus said, if someone strikes you on the right cheek, go ahead and turn the other cheek. He didn't say the magistrates are supposed to, every time a criminal walks in and who's killed someone, say, well, I'm going to turn the other cheek and let you walk. That's not justice, and that's not love. It certainly isn't love to the future victims of that person.
Steve, what
administrating a nation, is a much more complex issue than simply managing your own relationships with people who don't like you.
So in the Old Testament days, was it a theocratic society where the laws of the religion and the laws of the land identical?
Absolutely. All yeah, right. That's what. Yeah, Israel was a theocratic nation.
All right. I wasn't sure about that.
Yeah. Yeah, so that's why it was.
All right. Well, Steve, that was a very comprehensive answer. I really appreciate it. And
hey, it's good talking to you again, Michael. We'll talk again.
Are you coming to Santa Cruz anytime soon?
I'm coming up for a memorial service at the end of this month for my friend David Beaudry, who died a couple months ago. And it's going to be the last Saturday of this month. I'll be up there for that.
Well, will you be giving a teaching?
Yes, I think so. I think Saturday night I'll be speaking at Christian Life Center.
All right.
That'll be on the website.
Okay. Thank you, Steve.
Okay, Michael. Good talking to you.
Same here. Bye-bye.
Bye now. Okay. Let's see. Brandon from Salinas, California is next. Welcome to The Narrow Path, Brandon.
Hi, Steve. Thanks for taking my call today.
Yeah.
Lectures that you did about what are we to make of Israel, the most recent ones, I've made a CD of them, and I listened to them in the car, and they've been really edifying to me.
Have you heard the whole series?
I've heard the whole series, and I'm on my second go-around through the lectures. And I get more and more out of it each time because you do a really thorough job in covering all the bases. And,
they are kind of information dense. I know it, you probably can't get it all one time through. Yeah.
Well, at least not fully in depth, because a lot of the history of Israel and Palestine, the conflict, I wasn't aware of a lot of the details of the historical events. So that part's been particularly enlightening. But anyway, I have both a comment and a question, and I'll say the comment, and then I'll ask the question and hang up.
Okay.
The comment is about Revelation 7, the call earlier about the two omitted tribes.
Yeah.
I don't know if this is why they were omitted, but it occurred to me that Dan and Ephraim, if you look at what the names mean, Dan means judge.
Judging.
And exactly, and Ephraim is fruitful in the land of my affliction, like the original context.
Yeah.
So it may be that those names are used because the preserved Jews out of the 144,000 are not going to be receiving judgment, and they won't be in the land of the affliction, so to speak, but they'll be fruitful elsewhere. I don't know.
Well, that's an interesting thought. Yeah.
Because also I thought, too, that the golden calves were in Bethel and the city of Dan.
Yeah.
So maybe there's like an etymology because Bethel's in Ephraim, so I don't know if since they're being preserved and not judged, that
those are good points. Good
out.
Suggestions.
But okay, so that's the suggestion, and then the question is about 1 Samuel 7:2, where it says the ark was in that house for 20 years. And in the book of Acts, Saul was king for 40 years, so I wanted to know how you work out the timing.
Well, Saul was not yet king. I see. I got you. Because it was there through the reign of Saul,
correct,
obviously, and then David brought it out from there. Yeah,
right.
That's a real good question. I have to look at that again to be able to answer that intelligently, and I won't have time to do that right now. But it's very possible, and it would not be the only case known, that the number 20 in 1 Samuel chapter 7 is a scribal mistake, because the numbers in the Hebrew language often look very much like each other, and there's quite a few recognized cases in the Old Testament where scholars recognize that the number that has come down to us in our present manuscripts probably has undergone change through an accidental miscopying. For example, in one place it says that Solomon's horse's chariots stalls were 4,000, and in the parallel over in Chronicles it says they were 40,000. Same verse, same statement, but one makes the number of stalls of his chariot horses 4,000, the other 40,000. Seems obvious that one of those was miscopied by a copyist. And this kind of thing happens from time to time. So it is possible that the 20 years is not really what it originally said. It might have been 40 years or 40. It could have been 60 years, because the numbers in the Hebrew don't always look different enough for the copyists, especially if they have a blurred copy or a copy that's defective or cracked or has a moth hole through it when they're copying it. They sometimes can't read what it is, and they put down what they think is right. And unfortunately, that has happened from time to time. But fortunately, those numbers, if they've come down to us wrong, don't have any impact on our knowledge of God or our Christian walk. It'd be nice if we didn't have any textual mistakes in the Bible, but there are some. And that could be one. I'm not sure that's the answer to that particular case. I would have to look at it again, and I haven't looked at it in the last 24 hours, so I'm going to have to defer to another time trying to give you a good answer to that. Okay. But I'd have no trouble with the idea that it could be a textual corruption, a miscopy, but I'm not sure that that's the right answer in that case.
Yeah, it could be. I don't know if this is the case, but it may be that the 20 years is in reference to the time that it, actually, no, it couldn't be. Never mind. I had a thought, but that can't be the case.
Yeah, I was trying to work something out in my head, too, and it didn't work for me either.
Yeah. Right now I'm going through 2 Kings and 2 Chronicles. I've been going through the whole Samuel, Kings, and Chronicles, and mm-hmm. I'm reading them in parallel, and it's really interesting to compare the Chronicle account with the Kings accounts, especially where there's the details filled in from the Chronicle account versus the King's account, and vice versa.
Yeah, they just supplement each other. You're right. Just like the four Gospels supplement each other.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. So, okay.
All right.
Thanks.
I appreciate your call.
Uh-huh.
God bless you. I've got more callers waiting, but I only have about 60 seconds before the music begins to play. I'm going to go ahead and give Scott, who's been waiting a long time, the option. Can you say what you want to say in 60 seconds, or do you want to call back another day when we've got more time, Scott?
60 seconds. Would you give all of the commentary you can on the unforgivable sin, and do you believe that Jesus on the cross at Calvary took care of that, or that he is in the Father and the Father is in him and us through him see the Father, wherein the unforgivable sin is the Lord's will, Yahweh's will? And so,
well, let me answer that if I can, because the music's going to start playing in 15 seconds and you may not finish your sentence by then. I'll tell you what. I believe that there is a sin which, if people are guilty of it, they will not be forgiven. But not because God won't forgive, but because they won't repent. I believe there comes a time when a person has hardened himself against God so much that his heart is simply beyond repentance in this life. And Jesus didn't say God won't forgive them. It says they will not have repentance. It says they will not have repentance, or forgiveness, excuse me. They won't have forgiveness in this age or the next. So I think the reason they won't have forgiveness is because they won't have repentance. That's my short answer, and certainly a 60-second answer is not adequate for that question, but that's all we've got. We've got 30 seconds now, so I'm going to have to end it there. I appreciate your call. I'm sorry I couldn't do better with it. You've been listening to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. We are a listener-supported ministry. If you'd like to help us stay on the air, you can write to the Narrow Path, P.O. Box 1730, Temecula, California, 92593. Or you can donate from our website, where everything is free, but you can donate there too, thenarrowpath.com. Thanks for joining us, and God bless you.